This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Good to have you with us. Ahead this hour, we'll have a conversation with Emily Wilson, professor of classical studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She's won a MacArthur grant for her work translating classical literature. We'll also tackle the subject of school lunch debt and lunch shaming. Child advocates say children should not be punished because families are behind on their lunch bills. But to start the show, we catch up to a controversial proposal by the nonprofit Safe House meant to ease the opioid crisis, a supervised injection site likely to be located in the Kensington area. On Wednesday, federal judge Gerald A. McHugh ruled that such a site would not violate the so-called crack house law, writing in part, the ultimate goal of Safe House's proposed operation is to reduce drug use, not facilitate it. It's an important win for Safe House and other harm reduction advocates, but the story is not over. Justice Department officials say they will appeal. As always, if you'd like to share your thoughts or have any questions, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. Rhonda Goldfein is vice president and co-founder of Safe House, and she joins us now in studio. Welcome, Rhonda.
Good morning.
So what does Wednesday's ruling mean to Safe House's plan for a supervised injection site? Is there cause for tempered optimism?
We are certainly cautiously optimistic. The judge's thoughtful opinion, and it's 56 pages, so that is a thoughtful, well-reasoned opinion, concludes that our purpose, Safe House's purpose, which is to save lives, is not one of the prohibited purposes listed in the crack house statute.
So remind us quickly how the supervised injection site works.
We envision a site where folks will come in, they'll register, there'll be an assessment of what their condition is, their physical health, their behavioral health. They'll be offered a full range of services, from the ability to consume on-site to medication-assisted treatment on demand. Based on the services that the participant requests, they'll go to that service. Perhaps they say, I'm feeling unwell, I need to consume drugs right now. They'll go to a spot where their consumption will be observed by medically trained personnel. If the participant begins to show signs of overdose, that trained team will be able to step up and begin to reverse that overdose. Assuming the consumption goes without incident, the person will have an opportunity to dispose of their used injection equipment. And I should say that when they go into the consumption site, they will be provided clean injection equipment consistent with federal law. They'll be given fentanyl test strips to assess whether fentanyl is present in their drugs. They'll go into the observation site where, again, they'll be offered treatment services. They'll be offered an opportunity to hear about medication-assisted treatment. They'll be offered referrals to primary care, wound care, other social services, legal services, and housing services.
Is that the ultimate goal?
The ultimate goal is to save lives. And, you know, we hear it a lot, but it bears repeating. It's important enough to repeat. You can't recover if you're not alive. Right. It's a little trite, but it's absolutely correct.
So, Rhonda, opponents say people are bringing an illegal drug into an establishment, are using in a sanctioned environment, which is against federal law. In you know, the language of the law, and paraphrasing here, it shall be unlawful to manage or control any place for the purposes of using controlled substances. How did Judge McHugh interpret this?
He did a thoughtful review of the cases. He did a thoughtful review of the legislated evidence of the statute. He refers to a lot of tools for decision making, and he concluded that the purpose here is the actor, and the actor is the entity providing the space, and that our purpose is not to encourage drug use. Our purpose is to save lives.
Tell us about the experience of supervised injection sites in other countries, such as Canada. Is the death rate significantly reduced? And do we know what percentage of users go on to treatment?
We know that at these sites all over the world, there are a couple of common truths. One, no fatalities in the site. Two,
no fatalities.
No fatalities in the site. There are Sites have been operating for 30 years in more than 120 locations. Not a single fatality in the site. Second thing we see, reduced fatalities in the vicinity of the site. Third thing we see, no or reduced public consumption, reduced drug-related litter, and no impact on crime, which makes sense because it's a public health measure, not a crime-fighting measure.
Well, some concerns, and including, I think the city has said, public safety concerns will have to be addressed, you know, if a supervised injection site were to be given final approval. Taking a look at some articles, and some neighbors in Kensington were concerned that, well, you know, if you've got a site here, then the dealers can't be far behind because there's a market. I mean, how do you react to concerns like that?
The dealers are there. I mean, what's happening in Kensington is a sad commentary. And that neighborhood needs some immediate relief. And that's true whether you're living in a house or living on the sidewalk up there. And we know that the neighbors have a lot of anger and a lot of pain. But we say what's happening now isn't working. Let us try something that's evidence-based that we can monitor in real time. Let us try something that's worked elsewhere.
Fentanyl, back to fentanyl for just a moment. It's been gasoline on the fire in this crisis. A tiny amount can prove to be deadly. Has it been more of a challenge in your experience at other sites to bring people back when they overdose on heroin laced with fentanyl?
No. You know, we had an evidentiary hearing in this case, and we had two doctors, one who is a toxicologist, clinical toxicologist, and an emergency department doc, and one who's an infectious disease doc. They both testified that fentanyl will reverse an overdose, that the question is not...
You mean naloxone. Forgive me.
Naloxone will reverse an overdose, and that the question isn't the quantity of fentanyl. The question is the timing. How quickly do you get the naloxone to the person who's overdosing?
This case is being watched closely by other U.S. cities, including Seattle and New York, and I think San Francisco. Did Deputy Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen effectively, you know, stop momentum elsewhere when he said after last week's ruling, any attempt to open illicit, as he put it, drug injection sites in other jurisdictions while this case is pending will continue to be met with immediate action? Was there a chilling effect here?
I can't speak for other jurisdictions. I know that former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein said the same thing in Philadelphia. He said it on HYY. If you're planning on doing this, you will be met with swift action. And we move forward not to be disrespectful to law enforcement, but because we simply disagreed with his analysis.
Mm. Guessing this is going to take some deep pockets, Rhonda, to fight this fight as far as it might go. Is the funding there? What sort of help comes from outside Safe House, which is a nonprofit?
Yes. On the legal front, we are fortunate to have a legal team that's working pro bono. My colleague, Alana Eisenstein from DLA Piper, they have pledged to support us until it gets done. So that's a great resource. In terms of raising funds to pay for staffing, to pay for supplies, to pay for locations, we're still working on that. But it's important to point out that the funding we seek to raise is not to support me or my colleague Jose Benitez or Governor Rendell. We all have day jobs. This is kind of our night job. So we're looking for money so that we can pay people to be in those sites to monitor and respond to an overdose if it should occur.
So as the legal questions continue, I mean, I haven't heard that the Justice Department has filed the appeal, but it's almost certain that they will. They stated that last week. So as far as this goes, the funding is there to take the court battle as far as it might go. That's what you're saying.
We have the resources. In some ways, better than money, we have a pro bono law firm.
Mm. So the Justice Department first sued in February. How long do you think, you know, should this particular proposal win approval every step of the way until such a site might actually be up and running?
We're optimistic about getting it done this year. I mean, let's think about it. This ruling was in response to the government's motion that they should win based on the facts as a matter of law. And the judge in his 56-page opinion, has soundly rejected that notion. So the case is not over. There's not a final order on the merits, but we are hopeful that there will be a final order, that won't be too much longer, and that with that, we'll be able to operate.
Do you have a site in mind?
We know that it has to be Kensington. And again, we understand how pained the neighbors are up there, but we can't walk away from the data. The heat maps show that Kensington is red hot in terms of the number of overdoses.
So what are you doing to build public support?
Well, I'm hopeful that an appearance like this gets people talking and thinking about it. We are eager to talk to the neighbors. We have talked to the neighbors. We're happy to go back and talk to the neighbors some more. And I think that there's some part of this that we need to put this in action. And that's not meant to be disrespectful to the neighbors, but I don't think that they will agree. And so our best hope is they will tolerate it. They will see that a change has come and that they will ultimately support it.
So if the site does go up, what does the neighborhood look like then? What do the streets look like in terms of people who are using, and this is obviously all, you know, imaginary at this moment, but also about the homeless populations who are using and who are kind of stuck in that cycle of using and homelessness. How do you envision that a change that this site might bring?
Well, we're hoping that the homeless who are using, and with the advent of fentanyl, they're injecting like 8 to 10 times a day. So we're hoping that instead of injecting between parked cars or in alleys or on the way to your kid's school, they will be inside our facility.
Got a comment from Dan who says the reason people don't want the site is because they want to develop these neighborhoods and they don't want people using nearby. It's a money grab. I hadn't heard that opinion before. What do you think?
I'm not sure who he's attributing the money grab to. I think the neighbors in Kensington are suffering, you know, no doubt about it. And they are, like anywhere in the city, entitled to have a neighborhood that they feel safe and that it's comfortable and clean. You know, if they have some other purpose, okay. But I think that our focus is on saving lives.
Why are you personally in this fight, Rhonda?
I run the AIDS Law Project, and for more than 30 years, we've provided free legal support to people in a public health crisis. And this is a public health crisis.
Rhonda Goldfein, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rhonda is vice president and co-founder of Safe House and also, as she mentioned, executive director of the AIDS Law Project of Pennsylvania. Just ahead on Radio Times, we will hear about school lunch debt and how some schools locally and nationally are shaming kids whose parents have not paid their lunch bills. That's coming up in just a few moments here on Radio Times. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As the new school year picks up steam, the debate over what to do about parents who don't pay the bill for school lunches rages on. School districts can find themselves saddled with thousands of dollars in lunch debt, but efforts to convince family in arrears to ante up can fall flat, and sometimes children are caught in the middle. A student whose account is behind might be offered a cheese sandwich instead of a hot meal or isn't given anything at all. Practice child advocates call lunch shaming, or efforts to collect money from parents can border on the extreme, as they did in Pennsylvania's Wyoming Valley West District earlier this summer, when an official sent out letters to parents warning that their children could be placed in foster care if the bills weren't paid. After a national outcry, Wyoming Valley West accepted a donation from La Colombe CEO Todd Carmichael to wipe out $22,000 in debt. So, what to do? How do school districts make certain every child gets at least one good meal during the school day? minus any embarrassing attention while managing costly lunch debt. Here's the email address if you'd like to join the conversation, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Jennifer Gaddish is author of the forthcoming book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Welcome to Radio Times, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with the story of a local school district in New Jersey, the Cherry Hill District, which has grappled with over $14,000 in lunch debt. In August, the district prompted a public furor and national headlines when it decided to serve students who have overdue meal fees tuna sandwiches instead of a hot meal. After a public outcry, the district said, okay, let's change the policy. And we are going to get to some of, you know, the district's other proposals in just a moment. But you know, some would say, well, what's wrong with a tuna sandwich that also comes with milk or juice and a piece of fruit? What do you think? What's your reaction?
Well, one of the things that I found so surprising when I actually read that news story was that the district had initially considered giving a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but then decided that the children might actually like that too much. So I think that certainly a tuna fish sandwich can be something that is healthy, particularly when it's served with the fruit and vegetable and milk. But I think that the intent behind it is to be a punishment such that children feel these negative emotions and then communicate that negativity that they experience in the cafeteria to their parents. So I think that the people who are really critical about this practice of school lunch shaming really view it as a kind of like emotional blackmail for students in order to get their parents to kind of pay up when parents might not actually have additional income to devote to paying their lunch debt in the first place. So I think one thing that's kind of important to keep in mind is that the data on school lunch debt actually shows that charitable contributions are like the number one source of payment to help with paying down debt in school districts nationwide. And next to that is school district general funds. And the third source of payment that contributes the most to eradicating lunch debt is payment from students and their parents. So it's not even like so effective, right? Yeah. I think that it's important to keep that in mind.
Let's get back to Cherry Hill for just one more moment. So the newest proposals would allow a student in debt to select a hot meal, no a la carte, but they still get a hot lunch when the debt is $10. At $25, parents are contacted to talk about the outstanding balance. At $75, there's a mandatory meeting with local school officials. And at this point, privileges like prom might be withheld. So even though there are some of these alternatives like public donations, some school districts feel that they, you know, they might have to resort to tougher tactics to get parents to ante up.
You know, I think it's not an easy situation because a lot of school districts are, you know, dealing with pretty tight finances. But my personal opinion is that it's never the child's fault or the student's fault. And I think withholding things that are part of the normal social experience of a public school is really not the appropriate response. But I do recognize that individual school districts might be in kind of a tough bind. And I think that that's one of the reasons why it's really important to focus at the national level, because all the funding is coming for the most part through the National School Lunch and Breakfast Programs for school meals. So I think that the real goal for a lot of people in terms of what it would look like to actually address the root causes of this issue would be to move to a universal free model of school meals so that individual school districts aren't kind of faced with this, you know, this challenge of, well, you know, we don't want to do this, but we have to get the money from somewhere, because they would actually be getting money for all of the children who eat school meals directly from the federal government.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about what's happening in Austin, Texas in just a moment. But first, let's take a look at how a child's family can fall behind in lunch payments. Not sure you've got this information right at hand, Jennifer, but some students are eligible for free or reduced priced meals, of course. How is this determined, and what do these meals generally look like?
So it's determined based on federal poverty threshold. So for families with incomes below 130% of the threshold that the federal government sets, so it's $32,000 $32,630 for a family of four currently. So any family that has a lower income than that would be eligible for free lunch for their children. Students from families with incomes that are above that value but below 185% of the threshold, so about $46,000 for a family of four, would qualify for reduced price lunches that are typically 40 cents. So even that 40 cents can be challenging for some families, particularly because, you know, there are so many people in low-income jobs in the U.S. So I think that that's a real challenge sometimes, is affording that 40-cent cost, particularly if you have multiple children. But really, I think that the biggest issue and the families that are most likely to fall into school lunch debt are those that are just barely above that threshold for free and reduced price lunches, because they might be paying, you know, $3 for each of their child's school lunches. And I think that that's where people can get into some trouble. And nationally, if we look at the data, we can see that basically the amount of school lunch debt and the frequency, so like how often schools are likely to experience school lunch debt, is directly related to the percentage of students that qualify for free and reduced price lunches. So the more students that are qualifying for free and reduced price lunch, typically the less problem that they have with lunch debt, because they're actually getting those federal reimbursements instead of relying on parents' individual ability to pay for the school lunches.
Let's talk about potential stigma attached to free or reduced price meals that might prevent a family from applying. And if so, how do you get around this with families?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a huge issue. And I think particularly when school lunch isn't really thought of as being a very high quality thing. So I think in school districts that have really invested in moving away from the heat and serve model of, you know, chicken nuggets and rectangular pizza, like from when I was a kid, to really serving healthier meals and meals that are made from scratch and like having salad bars and things like that, I think that they're able to attract more parents who would be paying for their children's meals to actually participate in the National School Lunch Program. So one thing I think is important for listeners to kind of understand is that this program that we have nationally, currently about 30 million children participate in it, and another 20 million children who have access to the National School Lunch Program, meaning it's offered at their schools, they currently don't participate. So they might bring a lunch from home, or they might, if their school has an open campus policy, leave and go somewhere else, like to like a corner store or fast food restaurant, something like that, and then come back to school. So I think in order to get like that 20 million group of students who disproportionately are from like middle and upper middle class families to opt back into the National School Lunch Program, that's a really important goal if we're to ever reduce the stigma surrounding like eating in the cafeteria, and in particular eating the lunch that's provided by like the federally subsidized school lunch program.
Got some comments coming in. Email from Cindy, who says it's shameful that schools practice lunch shaming. Some of us are struggling financially. We pay enough in school taxes, so I think both breakfast and lunch should be free to our kids. Also from Dave, he says, when I was in high school, if you forgot your lunch or had a cafe balance, you could make your own PB&J or cheese sandwich. It was no big deal then, and it's no big deal now. I wasn't ever ashamed. Your thoughts, Jennifer? Jennifer Gaddis?
Yeah, well, I think that I would agree with the first comment that we really should have a universal free breakfast and lunch program. I think that there are a ton of benefits that come with that. On the one hand, you're able to create a much more inclusive environment for kids where they feel, not shamed over what they're eating. And there's a lot more opportunities for doing things like nutrition and food education when food is really seen as a regular part of the school day and not something that we're sort of treating children differently based on their class, so their socioeconomic class. So I think that there's a really compelling case for moving toward a universal free model. One of the things I talk about in my book is actually that I think when we have this kind of universal model, it also really helps school districts with their finances because it makes it a lot easier for them. They already have a lot of costs that they have to pay for, even if, you know, only 50% of kids are participating, and it starts to give them a lot more money to work with to do things like pay like better wages to cafeteria workers or source more food from local farmers or things of that nature that are really about community economic development when they have a higher number of children participating, because it just brings more money, like more revenue into the system. So I think that it would be really great to move to that model. And as far as the second comment goes,
he didn't feel shamed. He said,
I think that things have gotten worse. And that's actually one of the things that the data kind of shows us. So the School Nutrition Association has been tracking what school lunch debt looks like across the country. And what they found is that the actual amount is actually increasing. So 40% of the school districts that they surveyed said that in the last year, the total amount of lunch debt that they are having to figure out how to get back has actually increased from an average of $2,500 to $3,400.
Well, there's a change go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just going to say there was a change in Pennsylvania law in 2017. Lawmakers outlawed a practice of denying a lunch to students who couldn't pay for it. And, districts aren't allowed to serve alternative lunches like the cold sandwich. And they can only communicate with parents, not students, about monies it owed. And then a lot of districts found their debt ballooning. Again, what are the answers here? Because sometimes, if you're tens of thousands of dollars of lunch debt, that eventually might be passed along to taxpayers. If a district that's on a tight budget can't afford that.
Yeah, I mean, my personal opinion is that nobody is intentionally falling into lunch debt. Like most parents, they are in that situation because they're really struggling to make ends meet. So I think it's actually important for us, particularly in this country where we have such an overproduction of low-wage jobs, and there are a lot of people really working hard who can't afford all of the various forms of debt, that exist in their lives. I think raising children is really expensive, and I think it's worth investing as a country, so as taxpayers, and making sure that all children are fed a healthy meal without any kind of stigma. So I think that this question of taxpayers paying for things, I think that to me it's a savvy investment now, because it's an investment in really helping children develop healthy habits and have good nutrition in their early years, which can really help prevent various kinds of dietary diseases later on in life.
And they just do better in school if they've got a good
good
breakfast, absolutely. Good lunch under your belt.
The academic piece is so huge, and we're already spending so much on the instructional component. It's actually pretty strange that the only piece that we really expect people to pay for is what happens in the cafeteria. It's you have to pay as an individual for that, but you don't have to for math or English classes or things of that nature. So I think that we need to really treat food as an educational part of the school day and fund it accordingly.
Back to the concept of universal free lunch, and to Austin, as we promised earlier, over the half of the schools within the Austin Independent School District offer free lunch to students because of a provision in 2010's Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act. If at least 40% of students in a school qualify for free lunches, the school can claim community eligibility, meaning all students automatically have access to free lunch. You referred earlier, I think paraphrasing you, Jennifer Gaddis, said it would be the best of all possible worlds to offer universal free lunch universally. What are the odds that's going to happen?
Well, I think that it's something that really is becoming a much more mainstream part of the conversation. So periodically over the last 100 years, there have been various campaigns for universal free school lunch. The most recent one that was really serious was in the 1970s. And I feel like when I was a kid in the 1990s, nobody really was talking about this in super mainstream circles. But now I see, for instance, in my Facebook feed, messages all the time, from some of the more progressive Democratic candidates for president, where this is a part of the conversation that they're having. So I think that there's a lot more awareness now, in part because of this issue of lunch debt and lunch shaming, about the need for universal free school meals. And I think that there's increasing public support for doing that, particularly as so many families are just feeling attacked in so many different areas of their lives financially, in terms of just, needing to pay for daycare, needing to pay for school meals, needing to pay for rent or a mortgage. There's so many different areas of life that we are individually economically responsible for. And I think it's important when it comes to raising children that we think about how we can actually use our our public institutions, so like schools and school kitchens and cafeterias, to make it easier for parents to do the work of really raising children in a high quality environment and a high quality way.
In the few moments we have remaining, back to Austin, lunches are apparently made from scratch. How does that work? And is it more expensive than the traditional, lunches that you get mass produced from a particular institution?
Yeah, I think that it can be just as cost effective. It really is one of those things where you're typically able to lower some of your ingredient costs, but then you might be spending more on labor. But I think that that's a good thing because it really means that you're spending more on local labor. So people who are actually living and working in your school community are getting access typically to longer hours. Whereas if they're just reheating a bunch of food that's produced in a factory that's far away and like shipped in, they might only have like a 3 or 4 hour position, and that kind of makes it hard for them to earn enough money to support themselves and their families. So I think it's more about kind of how the money is distributed versus if you're buying like only pre-made food, you're essentially paying for that factory to sort of cook the food for you. So I think that you can make it work, but I think that most school food service directors, including those who are doing really great work with scratch cooking and local sourcing, so farm to school programs, I think that they would say that there's a lot more that they could do if more families who are currently not participating in the school lunch program were to participate. And if we were to raise the reimbursement rate for school lunches, they could do a lot more to really use school lunch programs to support the development of local food and farm economies and to help not just food chain workers, so the people in cafeterias and like distribution warehouses in urban areas, but also to help farmers in rural areas. So I think it's really important with scratch cooking to recognize that it opens up so many more possibilities for using school lunch as not only a way to get healthy food to kids, but also to provide good job opportunities for people in industries that oftentimes are pretty low paid.
All right, Jennifer Gaddis, we're up against the clock, but thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Gaddis is assistant professor at the School of Human Ecology, University of Wisconsin-Madison, and author of the forthcoming book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Up next on the Radio Times Regional Roundup, Emily Wilson is University of Pennsylvania professor of classical studies. She's just won a 2019 MacArthur Grant for her work translating classical literature. Stay with us. Sounds like a good interview. Just ahead.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Emily Wilson is professor of classical studies and graduate chair of the program in comparative literature and literary theory at the University of Pennsylvania. Wilson is also newly a recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, informally known as the Genius Award, in part for her acclaimed translation of Homer's Odyssey. We are really excited to have her in studio with us for the remainder of the hour to talk about the award, her work, and what this means potentially for the field of translation. If you'd like to join the conversation, here's the email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Emily Wilson, so nice to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So you are one of 26 recipients of the 2019 MacArthur Grant, as it's called. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's an amazing honor.
There are apparently relatively few of your colleagues in the field of translation who have been awarded a MacArthur Grant. Were you expecting this?
Absolutely not. No, I certainly thought it was a prank call when they called me. No, it was a shock, and it's still hard to take in that it's real. Yes.
Yeah, was it a thrill?
It's absolutely thrilling. Yes, and as you say already, it's a wonderful thing just for the field of translation and for the field of ancient studies as well. I mean, I think for both those fields, it's wonderful just to bring more awareness to the fact that there's so much interesting work being done within literary translation and within the study of ancient cultures right now. Yes.
So let's talk about your work translating the Odyssey, mm-hmm. Homer's classic story of the Greek warrior Odysseus and his 10-year journey home from the war in Troy to his wife Penelope. When was the Odyssey composed?
Well, that every question you ask about the composition is going to be controversial. I think probably sometime in the 7th century. So the Greek-speaking world had no reading or writing for several centuries before the 8th century. And then at some point or other, probably fairly soon after literacy came to Greece, both the Iliad and the Odyssey were composed using writing.
So you are working with ancient Greek. Tell us about that language.
It's such a beautiful language. Yes, and Homeric Greek is unlike any other ancient Greek. It's a mix of different dialects from different parts of the Greek-speaking world. It's based on this very, very long oral tradition. So it's an amalgam of different dialects, different phrases that have developed over time through this folk poetry tradition. So it's a wonderful, Homeric poetry is a wonderfully rhythmical, metrical, kind of discourse that has these resonant phrases like rosy-fingered dawn, which keep coming up over and over again. It's a beautiful language.
So in translation, the correct interpretation of just one word can apparently make all the difference in the world in the understanding of a character's nature. In a New York Times article about your work in the Odyssey, you talk about the first adjective to describe Odysseus, polytropos. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, that's fine. Yes.
Okay. Which can be interpreted and was interpreted in a number of different ways. Tell us about that and your work in interpreting just one word so that you got your impression of this folk hero correct.
Sure. I mean, I guess I would take issue with the idea that there's a correct interpretation of any word, any literary text, right? I mean, of course, a poem has multiple different things it can be saying, right? And there isn't a single interpretation that's right. There's a range of things that could be possible interpretations. So Odysseus is a very unusual kind of Homeric hero. Unlike Achilles, who's always swift-footed, he's always going as fast as possible towards death. Odysseus is always multiple. So all of his epithets, almost all his epithets have to do with his multiplicity, his poly as in polygamy, right? Mm-hmm. It's to do with manyness. So in the first line of the poem, he's polu tropos, many turny. And of course, many turny isn't an English word. So I didn't want to write in words that are not English words. I wanted to convey some meaning, as I think the original does convey some meaning. It seems to me that epithet, it speaks to multiple different things. It speaks to Odysseus's own multiplicity, to the multiplicity of the journey that he goes on, that he's being turned around constantly. He's trying to get back home to Ithaca. He does this circular journey from Ithaca to Troy and back, but then he keeps going on loops and meanderings of being lost, being driven off course. And I think it's also a way of speaking about the poem itself, that it's a poem which has multiple layers in it. So I chose the word complicated to render it,
as an adjective to describe him.
To describe Odysseus. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to choose a word that could also apply to the poem itself, that could invite the reader to think about complexity, to realize that even though this is a very, very ancient poem, it's not a simple, primitive kind of poem. It's about a complicated hero, a complicated protagonist, and a complicated picture of society and of what it means to be in a community.
How long did it take you to do the entire translation? And also, how long might it take you to translate one word or one phrase till it becomes what you want it to be or envision it to be?
The whole project took 5 years, and I at many points thought there's no possible way I can do it in 5 years, and I'm going to need to beg for another decade, because it could easily expand to fill as many years as I had. I would very often be in the position of thinking, the Greek is crystal clear, I have no problem understanding any of the words, and yet I just don't see how to put it into English in a way that's going to convey that clarity. I would be constantly getting stuck on things I didn't think I would get stuck on. It wasn't like, because this is polytropos is a long word. Are the long words going to be harder? No. Very often the simple, easy words are the hardest. It was certainly hardest at the beginning. I mean, for the first 2 years, I was stuck almost all the time.
And then that sounds frustrating.
Well, it was an interesting kind of being stuck. I mean, I was constantly obsessed with it. So it wasn't that I was stuck somewhere I don't want to be. I was stuck exactly where I wanted to be.
A labor of love.
A labor of love, exactly, yes.
Okay. Well, who have you determined Odysseus to be?
Well, I've already said multiplicity is so important, right, that he's always pretending to be somebody else. So if somebody's essence is about being somebody else all the time, then what's the real him? Maybe the real him is, as he says to the Cyclops, I'm nobody. Maybe he is nobody, and maybe that's actually who he is. Or maybe he's... When he comes back to Ithaca, he tells several different false autobiographies where he says, I actually come from Crete and I'm this wheeling hustler kind of guy. And maybe those are also true selves.
He's complicated.
He's complicated. And he's also a different person in each of his relationships. I think it's one of the things that's very interesting about the depiction of homecoming in this poem is that it's not just about being in a physical place. It's also about the different relationships that Odysseus reestablishes with each member of his household. He's somebody different with his wife from the person he is with his enslaved swineherd. The person he is with his dog is different from the person he is with his poor bullied young son, different from the person he is when he's bossing his men around to get them to row him back to Ithaca.
His voice is not necessarily the primary voice. If I'm understanding some articles I read correctly, there are definitely voices of women, Penelope, mm-hmm. but also the females who live with her. And this was another interesting translation that you made of the word to describe them as opposed to what other translators came up with. You know, slaves, housemaids, whores, mm-hmm. As some translations call them. They meet a grisly end at the hands of Telemachus. Mm-hmm. Your translation of the description of these women in Penelope's household is telling. What do you call them?
I call
girls,
them
I believe.
Women, girls, and slaves. It's been striking to me to realize, I mean, not this doesn't just apply to women, but to enslaved people who are both male and female, that quite a lot of translators into English and also into other languages tend to present the enslaved people as servants, which I think is to do with we're so uncomfortable with the idea of an enslaving society that we actually want to erase it from the classics, yeah. even though, in fact, of course, antiquity was a slave-owning society. So when Odysseus gets back home to Ithaca, he slaughters all the suitors who've been harassing poor Penelope for the last few years. And then he delegates the final set of killings, the murder of the 13 slaves who've been claimed by the suitors of his wife.
These women, yeah.
These women and one man. So there's 12 okay. women and one man who've been claimed by the suitors. And he tells Telemachus to hack them to death with swords. Instead, Telemachus decides that he's been this dopey kid up to this point. He takes initiative and decides that instead he's going to hang the women. And then they chop off the hands and feet and genitalia of the man. So that I think it's the scene that's to do with claiming ownership of bodies that have been claimed by the other men. And that it's a kind of honor killing. It's about the restoration of honor. And it seems to me that some interpretations, including translations, present it instead as a scene of enacting justice, which
yes,
isn't
the,
how
the
I
word
would.
Whore is used, yes. but you do not use that.
No, so and the Greek doesn't use any equivalent.
Okay.
So it's just that I'm not putting in an element of that kind of judgment where I don't think the Greek text is doing that.
Yeah, who were these people, the women and the men? They were just people. They were people who were enslaved and who had no power.
They were people without power who were enslaved people owned in the household, yes.
Okay. So the Odyssey is a 12,110 line epic poem originally written in, and I hope I get the pronunciation here correct, dactylic hexameter?
Yes.
Oh,
well done.
Okay. Yes. Your translation is in an iambic pentameter. Is there an easy way to describe this sort of transformation for a fairly short radio segment?
Well, it was essential to me to use regular audible meter because, as I've said, it's a poem based on an oral tradition. It has this regular rhythm to it. It was performed out loud. I wanted to invite the modern reader to either read out loud or at least just hear a beat in her head. And it seemed to me that the only way to do that is to use a native Anglophone meter. And obviously, iambic pentameter is the meter that's run through English poetry for the last few hundred years. So I wanted not to do what I think many translators into English have done in contemporary times of using either prose or free verse. I wanted it to have a very clear rhythm. The fact that I was translating from a longer line, a hexameter, which has 6 feet, into a pentameter, which has 5 feet, and I also wanted to keep up the pacing by keeping the same number of lines, it meant that I then also used quite a lot of fairly short words. And I felt that the clarity of that was actually truthful to something in the original. The original has this kind of clarity that I hoped I could get through that way.
Did you run into some real challenges in trying to make
it? Oh, yes, I did.
I imagine you did.
It was tough, yes.
Yeah.
But it was a fun kind of tough, yeah.
So your readers, if you're going to spend a lot of time on phrases and maybe on one word, how do you want people to approach the Odyssey? I assume taking their time, spending maybe not, you know, a few weeks, but maybe a month or so, and really absorbing what is written in the meaning?
I think it's a poem that you can read at any pace, any state, any speed, any time of your life. I mean, I've heard from a lot of readers who say that they found my version a real page-turner, and they were surprised to realize that they actually, you know, stayed up late flipping the pages, and they got through it much faster than they thought. I don't feel betrayed by that. I think that's a good thing. I mean, in antiquity, people presumably very often just heard a huge chunk of it over the course of drinks and dinner. I didn't intend for it to be a kind of text where you would have to pause to puzzle and figure out what exactly does that sentence mean, which I don't think the original is. I wanted it to feel like you want to know what happens next. It's exciting.
You are the first woman to publish a translation of the Odyssey into English. This is a male-dominated field?
The translation of ancient Greek and Roman texts is a very male-dominated field, and it's surprising because, of course, there are many female classicists and there are many translations of the Odyssey into other languages by women. But there are little pockets of classical studies that are still extremely male-dominated. This seems to be one of them. And I think it's also to do with how people think about translation, that we tend to think it doesn't matter who a translator is because you just want the correct interpretation. But in fact, the interpretation is going to depend on who you are, where you're coming from, both in terms of what you've read before and also what your life experiences
are. There's
no
one
correct interpretation. There's no one correct interpretation.
Your parents are both academics.
No, that's one of them.
Your mother is an academic. Your dad's an author.
My dad's a writer, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, so how have times changed for you and your work as compared to your mother's era?
Both in every possible way and also not entirely, right? I mean, I think there are still gaps in terms of how many women versus men get the big tenure track jobs, the big prizes, all those kinds of things. I was the founding member of the Somerville Creche at Oxford. My mother's taught for all her career at a historically women's college in Oxford, which is now not a women's college anymore. I think just in terms of work-life balance and childcare and maternity leave policies, there are some positive changes, but I don't think we've solved everything for sure.
What drew you to classical literature?
So many things. I mean, when I was 8 years old, I played Athena in the elementary school play that my school had, and that got me excited about Greek myths in general. I started learning Latin in high school, and I loved the structure of the language. I loved the clarity of the way that it laid out patterns of how is a sentence built. I also loved, right from the beginning, how the literature, the texts that you could read once you started learning Latin and Greek was these really complicated, I mean, maybe coming back to the word complicated, these complicated depictions of society and of human emotions that were still so vivid even after 2,000 or 3,000 years, that you can have this access to cultures that are both entirely different from ours and also we can understand them.
What are the similarities between those cultures and today?
We still have wars. We still have inequality. We still have feelings. We still have complicated relationships with each other. We still struggle to form communities, to talk to each other across gaps of differences of culture, differences of power, differences of agency.
So humans haven't changed all that much.
Humans have changed radically and also not. Both things are true, I think. Yes.
So the MacArthur Grant comes with a no-strings-attached award of $625,000, which offers a fair amount of freedom in your work.
I'm working on the Iliad right now, and I hope that one thing it may do is just give me a little bit of extra time to work on that very long and wonderful poem. Beyond that, I'm not entirely sure what else I think it's going to do. I mean, I think it would be lovely if it just brings more publicity to translation, more publicity also to issues about diversity within the field of classics.
When did you start the Iliad?
A few months ago.
Yes. So do you see, are there similarities in your work with the Iliad as there were with the Odyssey?
It's a both very similar poem in a way, in that they're both about elite warriors who are separated from their community and the struggle of how does Achilles get back with his group, just as how the question of the Odyssey is, how does Odysseus get back with his community? The world of the Iliad is totally different, though. The whole mood of the poem is so much darker. Whereas the Odyssey takes place in this expansive world where we're going from one island to another, all over the Mediterranean, the mood is so different. In the Iliad, we're in this claustrophobic horror of between the sea and the walls, and there's no way out, and people are just going to keep on killing each other.
When might we see the finished product?
Well, 5 years unless the MacArthur speeds it up.
Okay. Well, we're out of time, but Emily Wilson, such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And Emily Wilson is professor of classical studies at the University of Pennsylvania and a 2019 winner of the MacArthur Grant. Don't forget to connect with us here at Radio Times on social media. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.